Okay, look, so what? You put on a little weight.
A little weight? Does this look like a little weight to you?
Weight can fluctuate from year to year.
Fluctuate? You make it sound like I'm retaining water. I've gained 45 pounds in a week. Pete, what's happening to me?
What's your diet like?
Milk and cookies.
Really?
But I don't finish all the milk.
Well, then there is your problem. Just try to cut back on the sweets, okay? Anything else?
Yeah. How fast does hair grow? Facial hair.
What?
I shave in the morning. In the afternoon, I look like this.
Well, it could be a hormonal imbalance.
That would explain the mood swings.
Mood swings?
Yeah, but look at my hair. It's turning gray.
Oh, it's middle age, buddy. It happens. And with that body, you should be thankful you have hair. Look, if it bothers you, you can dye it, and you should dye it. just kidding.
You know, if you were listening to R&B and hip-hop in the early 1990s, you probably heard the group Janae. They actually had 5 top 40 singles, including that one we just heard, which is a song called Shame, which serves as a sort of theme song for one of the movies we're about to discuss. Welcome to Out of Touch, John. My name is Mike DeKalb, and on the other end of the line is my co-host, Chad Smart. Chad, are you ready for what should be a different but fun episode?
I am. You know, when you gave me this rundown and we decided how we were going to break the movies up, I was kind of, you know, curious how this would come out. But I think this is going to be an interesting discussion of some films that our audience may not be familiar with, plus a couple that they should be if they have been going to the movies since the 90s.
Yeah, for sure. And I know we mentioned this on our last episode, but Ed Wood was the last film that Touchstone Pictures released in 1994, but Disney managed to put out 5 more films before the end of that year. And so we thought we'd do like we normally do for the Disney and the Hollywood pictures. We'll just give a brief overview of these 5 films, you know, the talent involved and the box office performance, all in the name of seeing how they fit into the Disney catalog with our Touchstone Pictures. And so we'll just jump right in with the first film, which was released by Hollywood Pictures on October 21st, 1994, and it's called The Puppet Masters.
From Hollywood Pictures, on October 21st, they're coming to invade our minds.
They override the human nervous system.
To take over our bodies. And once this terrifying invasion begins, there's only one man who can stop it.
How many are you?
Get it off him! Get it off!
Donald Sutherland, The Puppet Masters, whatever you do, trust no one. Rated R. Starts Friday, October 21st at a theater near you.
Now, this was based on the classic science fiction novel by Robert Heinlein, who also did some legendary works such as Stranger in a Strange Land and Starship Troopers. The screenplay adaptation was by some names that are kind of went on to greater things after this movie and some before as well. The duo of Ted Elliott and Terry Rossio, of course, they were coming off of Aladdin for Disney, but their first film, Chad, do we remember Little Monsters?
I know of the film, but I have never seen it. I've never brought myself to watch that film, and I feel like I should at some point.
Oh, really? I thought that would have right up your alley with Fred Savage. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's why I said I'm surprised I have not seen it, but I don't know. Maybe I'll watch it after we get done recording.
And then they collaborated on the screenplay for this film with David Goyer, who had previously written Death Warrant with Jean-Claude Van Damme. And he also wrote another movie that I feel like I'm going to have to search this one down. It's called Arcade. I wasn't sure if you'd heard of that one either.
No, that one's new to me.
Yeah, it's about a virtual reality game that like takes over the people who play it, and it's like a mind control thing. And it stars Megan Ward and Ralphie himself, Peter Billingsley.
Interesting. You know, I know Ralphie from obviously Christmas Story and The Dirt Bike Kid, and then nothing until he became Vince Vaughn's friend. So.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Now, The Puppet Masters was directed by Stuart Orme, who was a British filmmaker, mostly known for some television and music videos for groups like Level 42. He worked with Genesis and Phil Collins a lot. He'd also did the Three Sides Live concert film for Genesis in the early 1980s. The only feature he'd done at that point was a movie called The Wolves of Willoughby Chase, which is a British film. I'm not familiar with that one. Now, the plot of this movie seems simple, but maybe it's convoluted. I guess it's all up to you. Aliens invade Earth in the form of parasitic slugs that control people's minds, just like in that movie Arcade we were just talking about. The government investigates, led by Donald Sutherland and his son Eric Thal, and they also are joined by Julie Warner, who plays a NASA specialist. We also have co-starring roles from Keith David and Richard Belzer. I wish I could give you my thoughts on this film, but I hate to say it, Chad, I could not bring myself to watch it.
I think you're doing yourself a disservice. I did watch this. I'm not going to say, oh my gosh, this is one of the best Hollywood Pictures movies that we've watched, but I was pleasantly surprised. You know, when I first saw the title of this pop up on our rundown, obviously my mind went to the horror film Puppet Masters, and I was like, wow, I did not realize that was a Disney film. Mm-hmm. But, you know, then looking into it, I'm like, oh, okay, it's not that Puppet Masters, but it's an early 90s film. And
yeah,
I don't know if this is going to make sense to you, but do you remember Tech War or even like Renegade, the Lorenzo Lamas show? Like,
yeah.
This just felt like a movie version of that time period, if that makes sense. it felt like a TV show, I guess, that was made into a movie or released as a film.
Yeah, no, the trade, like I was, that's the thing. Like I didn't watch it for a couple of reasons. Number one, I mean, I've been really busy and we had a lot of movies to discuss on this episode. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, the subject matter didn't interest me. And I wasn't really excited after I watched the trailer. Like I thought if the trailer could kind of bring me in, and all I kept thinking about was it looked like you said, like a very early 90s dated, which I don't mind watching those. I get kind of nostalgic about them, but I just, yeah, this one just didn't strike me as something I wanted to spend my time with. And that's why the show is not called Out of Hollywood, right? So I figured I don't have to see all of these. We could talk about them in the grander scope. I'm glad that you were able to watch it and give us some thoughts. And also, Chad, I don't know if you saw this or not. If you go to the Wikipedia page for Puppet Masters, there's a blurb about how the screenwriters had issues with the Disney executives and their vision of the film. And it had a link where you could click on an essay by Terry Rossio himself. And he talks about all the different changes that he was forced to make with the script. And that really also tempered my decision to not want to watch this movie, because I wonder if it felt like something that had too many hands on it and too many different creative decisions that were affecting the overall flow of the film.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. And I have a feeling like I'm not going to try to make this episode all about Puppet Masters, but there's actually a lot here that I want to touch on. And that is, are you familiar with the book at all? Or are you familiar with Robert Heinlein?
I mean, I'm familiar with Starship Troopers, and I've heard of Stranger in a Strange Land. I know that's like, you know, award-winning classic novel. I heard his name, but I'm not familiar with this book. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Meaning I didn't realize this was based on a book. And I read the essay by Terry Rossio about the changes that were made. And yes, I can say like, it does sound like a lot of studio interference and changing things. And because he says, you know, that their first draft stuck too closely to the book, which is kind of ironic, because most people, when they complain about a book to movie adaptation, they're like, oh, it strayed too far away from the book. But there were seven beats that he laid out that they tried to hit. And looking at those, I'm like, oh, I don't know how filmable they would have been. And also, I don't know, especially given a budget of what I'm sure Puppet Masters had. But I was thinking, have you ever read Needful Things by Stephen King?
All 800 pages of it? No, I have not.
I think it's only 650. But that was one that I read either like my senior year of high school or freshman year of college. And that was, I love the book and I wanted to make the movie. But then someone else beat me to it because, well, I have yet to make a film. But the movie came out in, I think, 94 or 95, around the same time as this. And yeah, that movie was very disappointing because it lacked so much of the book, because there's just too much crammed in, which is, I have a feeling the Puppet Masters would be the same way. There's just too much in the book to make into a 100-minute movie. And I think now, if you went back and they remade Puppet Masters now, obviously, you know, they could throw this up on Hulu as a, you know, 6-part limited series and mm-hmm. probably do a better adaptation, closer to the book adaptation.
Yeah.
But
they probably would do that. I can see that. I can honestly see that. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I thought this was interesting, and it is, I was going to look this up before, before I started recording, but I know the essay also mentioned that by the time they got around to kind of putting this into production, a remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers had been announced. And this movie kind of had a lot of similarities to Body Snatchers. So not just because it has Donald Sutherland either.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But no, it's, I think this is a underrated, not necessarily good film.
Okay. Well, I mean, I might bring myself to watch it eventually. I just, in the midst of everything that was going on, I was like, I'll just let this, I'll give Chad the soapbox. But before we do move on, I do want to point out, I always like to look and see if there are what I call personnel connections, where a lot of the actors and actresses in these movies have also been in Touchstone films. And it's fun to see these connections and see how they kind of, if these people are common and memorable to the Disney executives. And this film's got a few. Eric Thall himself, I noticed this was Eric Thall's fourth movie and the third one for Disney. He was in The Gun in Betty Lou's Handbag for Touchstone, and he was also in A Stranger Among Us for Hollywood Pictures. Julie Warner in 1993 had done Indian Summer for Touchstone. And Dale Dye, now, Chad, I don't know how big Dale Dye's role in this film was, but he also had a bit part and was the got a story credit for that U.S. Army propaganda film that Touchstone released in 1990 that they called Firebirds.
Well, you know, this movie does have a military element, so Dale Dye was kind of expected to show up.
That's his thing. That's basically his bag. I joke about it, but if two writers are sitting in a room and talking about making a military movie, their phone will ring and it will be Dale Dye on the other end agreeing to help be a military consultant for it, for sure.
Yeah. Mike, real quick before we move on, this is in the IMDb trivia section as well for this film, but I noticed it while watching the film, and it did give me a little chuckle. It's just one of those coincidences, fate things. But there's a scene early in the film where Julie Warner, Eric Thall, and Donald Sutherland go to investigate this crashed UFO. And these kids in the town where it crashed are selling for $1, you can go into the UFO and check it out. Obviously, that is where the aliens are then taking over people.
Mm.
And Julie Warner starts to go in, and then she balks. And hesitates. And Eric Thall says, oh, yeah, well, she backed out of going on Pirates of the Caribbean, too. And which, you know, you get that Disney connection of the theme park ride at the time. But Ted Elliott and Terry Rozier would go on to write Pirates of the Caribbean.
That I wonder if they put that in there. I wonder if that's what helped them get the screenplay or pitched to them back in the day by Disney. Yeah. Huh, that's so funny.
Yeah. And real quick, going back to that Rossio essay, he talks about the spaceship and slugs. Slugs are the main aliens in this film. I am confused of how slugs would, one, build, but much less fly a UFO. So that part of the movie I'm still trying to figure out. But
well, if we learned anything from Ed Wood, haven't you ever heard of suspension of disbelief?
it's fine. It's perfect. Let's go. Yeah,
exactly. Well, moving on. The next film actually came out the week after The Puppet Masters. It was released by Walt Disney Pictures on October 28th of 1994, and it's called Squanto, A Warrior's Tale.
Walt Disney Pictures presents the extraordinary journey of a young warrior taken from his family. Forced into a strange world, he found the courage to break free and the wisdom.
Put down your weapons!
To bring two worlds together. From the director of the Academy Award-winning Journey of Hope comes Squanto, A Warrior's Tale, rated PG. Starts Friday, October 28th at a theater near you.
This was written by Darlene Cravioto. This was actually her only feature credit. She'd done mostly TV movies, but she did get an Emmy nomination for a TV movie called Love Is Never Silent. The film was directed by Xavier Kohler, a German filmmaker. He'd done several features and TV movies in his native country, most notably 1990's Journey of Hope, which won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film. Now, this movie is loosely based on the life of Squanto, a Native American who helped greet the pilgrims in Plymouth and eventually create Thanksgiving. Adam Beach stars as Squanto. Mandy Patinkin plays a monk who teaches him English. And Michael Gambon, Dumbledore himself, plays Sir George, who is responsible for the shipping company that kidnaps Squanto. You know what's funny, Chad, is all I kept hearing about this movie is it's not historically accurate, but I found it really...
What?
Yeah. But at the same time, I found it really fascinating. Like, it's a movie that I think people should see, maybe to learn, even if it's not entirely accurate, at least they'll learn who the principals were and, like, and what was going on at that time in our history. You know, the film is beautifully shot. It's well acted, great set design, even though it is something we're going to come up with again later in this episode. It suffers from what I call, quote unquote, Disney villains, which is where, I mean, I know that these movies are kind of aimed towards kids, but we can't have any characters with any gray air. We can't have anti-heroes in Disney movies. It's got to be, this is the good guy and this is the bad guy. And so everybody who is on the opposite side of Squanto is just completely evil and is not trying to help him. Well, for the most, there's one guy that tries to help, but for the most part, the people that are really, really dastardly towards him and take him as a slave, they're just one dimensional and they're just the worst people. But it was also a fun adventure film that was really thought-provoking at the same time. What did you think of Squanto, Chad?
Well, I'm still trying to process how the studio that made Pocahontas would make a factually inaccurate film about Native Americans. That's boggling my mind. But, you know, I really liked when Stuart Pankin showed up.
Okay, you recognize Stuart Pankin? Okay.
Not necessarily the news. I was a huge fan back when it was on.
Yeah.
But this isn't, again, this isn't a bad film, but I think about 30 minutes in, I checked out to paying full attention to it, because I remember I texted you while I was watching it and being like, this is good, but who is the audience for this? Because, you know, at this time, I was trying to think, like, why would Disney make this movie? And I'm like, okay, it's, you know, a few years after Dances with Wolves had won the Oscar, and you had Geronimo, and I think Thunderheart with Val Kilmer had come out around the same time, you know, so like Native Americans were, I guess, in vogue at the time. But this movie, like I said, it just, like, the subject matter, if you went authentic, is more adult oriented, but the way that's played is for kids. I don't know who this was aiming to, you know, to appeal to.
Yeah. The only thing I could think of would just be trying to educate children. Like, because if you try to appeal to like history buffs, they're going to call you out on the accuracy of it. Mm. And so I think this is just basically what I was kind of hoping was for. It kind of introduced me to a character that I had no idea about. And the funny part is, and this is something, I don't know if it's a good or a bad sign when it comes to like a biopic, is that it makes you want to learn more about the actual history. And I feel like I went to Wikipedia immediately after watching this movie, and I didn't realize, and you realize how much of it is true and whatnot. And so maybe if someone wants to go back and make a mini series about him, they probably could, but at least they have something to start with, you know? And again, I was really impressed with, like I said, how well it was shot and the sets, you know, it really took me there, you know, in a way. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's well shot. Although, you know, my other question was, if you're going to get a filmmaker to direct a movie about Native Americans in the time frame of which this is, I don't know if a German filmmaker would have been my go-to.
Well,
again, I don't know. I'm not familiar with Kohler's filmography.
Well, I always used to, I mean, I remember hearing about this, and I saw this really great documentary about cinematography, and they mentioned how a lot of the great cinematographers are not American. And they said that they come to America and they have a different appreciation for the vistas and for the views of America because they're not from here. And so maybe that's what it was. Yeah. But yeah, at the end of the day, I wish more people knew about this movie. You know, thankfully it's streaming on Disney Plus, not a sponsor. And that makes it a little bit easier for people to find. From a personnel connection standpoint, not many. You mentioned Stuart Pankin. He had a bit part in the Touchstone film, I Love Trouble. Funny how I didn't remember that, because I didn't remember that movie. And he also was in the very first Hollywood picture, Arachnophobia. One of the actors, Alex Norton, who plays one of the villains, Harding, he also had a part in Blame It on the Bellboy. I'm sure if I saw that again, I probably put the two and two together. And did you notice, for future personnel connections, Squanto's wife in the film is played by the actress Irene Bedard. Chad, tell me who Irene Bedard is.
Mm, I'm guessing she doesn't change her name to Irene Cara later on.
Oh, I put you on the spot. A little trivia question. You know, yeah. Irene Bedard is the voice of Pocahontas.
Oh, yeah. I've seen Pocahontas once. And like I said, I immediately threw down my history books and said, lies, all lies. Yeah.
I've not seen it, but I'll watch it for this show. Mm. I think it's coming up next year on the podcast. Yeah.
Oh, you know, I thought, didn't Vanessa Williams have the theme song or a song from Pocahontas? So maybe I just assumed she was the voice of Pocahontas.
Oh, yeah. The singing voice, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, 2 weeks after this, Walt Disney Pictures comes up with another film that does a little bit better and is more entered in the public consciousness. Mm. On November 11th, 1994, they release The Santa Claus.
For Scott Calvin, becoming Santa Claus,
hey, you!
Wasn't something he wanted.
Killed him!
Did not.
If something should happen to me, put on my suit, the reindeer will know what to do.
Or was even very good at.
Santa?
But it's a job.
Ha!
He'll have a year to grow into.
What happened?
Bee sting.
Tim Allen.
Name?
Chris Kringle.
The Santa Claus. Name?
Papa Shisho.
Rated PG. Starts Friday, November 11th.
This was written by the writing team of Leo Benvenuti and Steve Ruttinger. They were comedy writers from Chicago who had mostly done sitcoms and, ironically enough, Tom Arnold specials. Interesting. This was their feature debut. It was directed by John Pasquin. He worked almost exclusively in sitcoms. Chad, if you watched television in the 1980s, you saw something that John Pasquin directed. Shows like Alice, Family Ties, Newhart, most notably Roseanne and Home Improvement, where he also served as a producer. Like the writers, this was his feature debut. And the star of Home Improvement is a star of our film. It's Tim Allen. The plot's, I'd say, somewhat simple. Tim Allen is recruited to be Santa Claus after he inadvertently causes the real Santa Claus to fall off of his roof. Eric Lloyd plays his son, while Wendy Crewson plays his ex-wife. And Judge Reinhold, the Honorable Judge Reinhold, is her new husband. Chad, I didn't watch it in advance of this podcast. I actually watched it last year on Christmas time, and I thought it was a really fun and entertaining Christmas movie. Sure, it's a little ridiculous, but I think it makes for a good holiday viewing tradition.
I just have two words for you. Topo Gigio.
Topo Gigio. People used to say that. And I'm like, what is that? I feel like you have said that to me over the years.
Probably, because I remember talking about. Yeah. I mean, I saw this in the theater when it came out, and I was in college. So I went with some college friends. And yeah, that was our takeaway was we would just randomly go Topo Gigio. But I'll admit, I did not watch this before this podcast. And I couldn't tell you the last time I saw it. But I think it is a good film, and you know I'd obviously recommend it to anyone to watch, especially around the holidays. And I know they just did a series on Disney Plus, not a sponsor, but I have not watched that. But yeah, I thought this was a fun holiday film.
Yeah, it's not side-splitting funny or anything, but it did put a smile on my face. It was a heartwarming fantasy, and I think it really makes for a good Christmas viewing in that regards. Like, you know, in my opinion, Christmas is not a time for to be cynical, right? And let me just show me something that makes me feel good and makes me think about the holidays. And that's kind of what this did. And, you know, and the interesting thing was this kind of jump-started Tim Allen's film career. It was a very successful transition for him. You know, at the time that this film was released, he was in the middle of season 4 of Home Improvement. And it goes on to be one of the great live-action Disney films of the Touchstone era. The sequel comes 8 years later. I didn't realize there was that much of a gap between the films. But maybe he was still doing Home Improvement and it was only doing, I guess he could only do one movie a year while in between the shooting schedule or something. But I think he'll come back to Touchstone a couple of times, at least one time that I can think of 10 years after this. But from a personnel connection standpoint, as we mentioned, Wendy Crewson, who plays Tim Allen's ex-wife in the film, she played the surgeon that treats William Hurt for cancer in the movie The Doctor. I totally forgot about that. The Honorable Judge Reinhold, of course, he was the star of Offbeat, Chad. When are we going to get that streaming or on DVD or something? And I almost forgot. He was in Ruthless People, of course. Mm-hmm. And then David Krumholtz, who plays one of the, I think he's like the main elf in the film, right? He was also really, really good in Life with Mikey. We love him in that one, yeah.
Look, I know you're Scott Calvin. You know you're Scott Calvin. So let's make this simple. I say name. You say Scott Calvin. Name?
Chris Kringle.
Name?
Sinterklaas.
Name?
Père Noël. Babo Natale. Père's Nicole.
Topo Gigio.
Okay, then 2 weeks after this, we get the final Hollywood picture of the year. On November 25th, 1994, they release A Low-Down Dirty Shame.
He's a private investigator.
I hear the lady screaming my name. Shame! Shame!
Where's Lorena Bobbitt when you need her?
She's his new partner.
Mike Tyson can beat Muhammad Ali.
That's right.
Mike Tyson can't spell Muhammad Ali.
Together, they're putting the competition to shame.
If you sing James Brown songs, dogs will not attack.
One, two, three!
Keenan Ivory Wayans.
All the dogs on the right go, ooh, ooh.
Get up!
Jada Pinkett.
Keep your day job.
A Low-Down Dirty Shame. Rated R. Now playing at a theater near you.
This was written and directed by Keenan Ivory Wayans. This was his second feature after I'm Gonna Get You Sucka. Chad, have you seen I'm Gonna Get You Sucka? Because I always enjoyed that movie.
I think he died from gold, didn't he? Or is it what is that the quote? Am I quoting it correctly?
Something like that, right? He had too much gold chains on. Gold, right?
Yeah. Platform shoes with goldfish in them. Yes.
I just remember one of the funniest scenes. I think I rented that on VHS back in the day. I mentioned I've grown up in Hawaii. It was kind of hard to see certain films in the theaters. But if I remember correctly, there is a scene in that movie where Jim Brown is like, God, I almost don't want to spoil it for the listeners. They're getting ready to go to the big showdown. And he like loads up all these different guns on his body. He's got them in every possible place you can put them, every holster you can think of. And as he's walking away, he slips on a bullet and falls. And then all the guns go off and they just keep going off. And I remember my buddy and I were like crying, laughing at it. Oh, God. Now I just spoiled it. You have to see it. But Keenan Ivory Wayans had also co-written Hollywood Shuffle and The Five Heartbeats with Robert Townsend. They came up together as well. The plot? Keenan Ivory Wayans himself. He plays Shame, an ex-cop turned private detective who goes after a drug lord while trying to find a witness who can testify against him, who also happens to be his former girlfriend. Jada Pinkett plays his assistant, and the very talented Charles S. Dutton plays a former police colleague who's now with the DEA. I hate to say it, Chad, but this was a pretty awful movie. You know, almost Razzie material. Like, it'd be good fun to watch with a group of people. And I watched it with my wife and we enjoyed watching it. Yeah, we were making fun of it as we watched it, but it's full of the worst police movie stereotypes. You know, I thought it was especially funny that the main villain, the drug lord, is named Mendoza. And all I kept thinking about was McBain from The Simpsons. Remember Mendoza was like his arch nemesis? And in addition to that cheesiness, it's also got jokes that certainly won't age well. I mean, there's racist jokes, there's homophobic jokes, there's sexist jokes. Chad, I think I counted two different Rodney King jokes. I mean, granted, this was 1994. That was a big year in the life of Rodney King. But it didn't really hold up very well in that regard. It's very dated in that regard.
Well, unfortunately, as we record this, this movie wasn't available to stream anywhere to watch. So I'm going off a memory of previously seeing this film. And yeah, I remember it not being, you know, I don't think it's a legendary film by any means, but I'm with you. I think it's a fun, just check your brain at the door, enjoy it for what it is type film. I mean,
yeah,
it's no Mo Money in the Wayans catalog, but it's also no White Chicks. So,
oh God, don't even remind me of that. Yeah. And that's the thing. I think that's what kind of got to me while I was watching. It was like all of the acting was just lousy, just lousy. Even someone like Charles S. Dutton, who's, like I said, he's so talented in this movie. He's just overacting so bad. And I wonder if is that a mark of the director not getting the great performance out of him? I don't know. And yet at the same time, it's sort of a fun time capsule because it reminds me so much of those early 1990s movies that are aimed at like African-American audiences. You know, it's complete with what I like to call an overused soundtrack. Like every single scene had some sort of unnecessary song just playing in the background. They're driving a car. There's got to be a song playing. They're walking into a room. Got to be a song playing, you know. And I grew up as a rap music fan and I watched a lot of those movies in high school, like New Jack City, Boys in the Hood, Juice, had all those soundtracks as well. You know, and I remember this film being out. I think I was listening to like Nirvana and Pearl Jam by the time this movie came out, not to mention waiting 30 years afterwards to see it. But I think it's because it was a comedy. Like I could enjoy those other action drama type movies for the ones for the urban audiences, right? But yet the comedies, it just doesn't quite translate, maybe. And I think, and the biggest sin of all was just making Keenan Ivory Wayans as like this bulletproof action hero, and he has just the cheesiest cliches and lines. And again, it's McBain. It really is McBain. But from a personnel connection standpoint, I totally forgot because it's been a while. My apologies to our listeners who were waiting for new episodes from us. Mm. Jada Pinkett was in The Inkwell in 1994 for Touchstone. We just recorded that episode so long ago. Charles S. Dutton, again, was really good in the Hollywood picture The Distinguished Gentleman with Eddie Murphy in 1992. And I also want to give a quick shout out to Gregory Sierra, who plays like that stereotypical police captain, you know, that's got, Shane, what are you doing here? You're not a police officer, you're a detective, or you're a private detective. And he was in Honey, I Blew Up the Kid for Disney. And if you go back to the 70s, he did a Disney film that I never even heard of until Disney Plus, not a sponsor, launch, and I saw it on the streaming platform. It's called The Castaway Cowboy with James Garner. I have not seen it yet, but I do really want to see that movie. But there's a part of me that I said it, in a weird way, I could see myself watching a Low Down Dirty Shame again, but only if I said I had a group of people. And you know what, before we move on, I want to ask you, Chad, this, I know it was more of an 80s thing, but what is the allure of private detectives? It seems like there were so many 80s TV shows, whether it be Magnum PI or Moonlighting or Remington Steele, Simon and Simon, right? It's like this idea, well, is it because they don't have to follow the rules of a cop and so they can kind of get away with more things and be more fun? It just seems like that private detective is so overused.
Yeah, I would say on the TV side, it is so that you can get around the cliches of cop work and go with cliches of a private detective work.
Yeah.
For movies, I would just say it's so you can make a cheap dick joke, since private eyes are known as dicks. Speaking of which, have you seen the Don Knotts Tim Curry movie Private Eyes? Classic. Mm-hmm. Why is it not on Disney Plus? I don't even know if it's a Disney film, but it should be on there anyway.
Oh no, I can't say that I've seen that. All right, well, the last of our five films was released on Christmas Day 1994 by Walt Disney Pictures. And it's called The Jungle Book.
On Christmas Day, one of the world's best-loved animated classics comes to life as Walt Disney Pictures unwraps the legend of The Jungle Book. This holiday season, get ready for the adventure that's exploding with excitement, overflowing with fun.
Sound it off!
And only at a theater near you.
You're all very exciting.
The Jungle Book, rated PG, starts Sunday, December 25th at a theater near you.
Now, of course, this is based on Rudyard Kipling's legendary novel. The adaptation was by the writing team of Ronald Yanover and Mark Geldman. Now, their only previous feature credit was Cyborg 2, 1993, starring an 18-year-old Angelina Jolie. The film was also co-written with the director of the film, Stephen Sommers, who had just done Adventures of Huck Finn for Disney the year before. And he had also written a movie called Gunman. I only bring up Gunman because I know we talked about it on the Terminal Velocity episode, but Gunman was directed by Darren Serafian, who did Terminal Velocity, who also did Death Warrant, which was written by David Goyer, who also wrote Puppet Masters, who was in Diner with Kevin Bacon. There you go. No, I'm kidding. I just see when I was doing the research for this episode, I kept coming back to the name Darren Serafian. It's so funny. And Death Warrant. Yeah. But The Jungle Book. Yes, this is a live action adaptation of the beloved Disney classic. It's the story of Mowgli, a young man raised in the jungle, living with a group of animals that become his friends. You know, this time it's updated to add in a love story and also some action and adventure. Jason Scott Lee stars as Mowgli. Lena Headey plays Kitty, his love interest. Sam Neill plays her father, a British officer. Cary Elwes is the villain and also forms the love triangle between Mowgli and Kitty. And in a nice little limited turn, we get John Cleese playing a doctor and family friend. Chad, what were your thoughts on this live action version of The Jungle Book? I know when I was doing the research, it's hard to find material on this because everything points you to the Jon Favreau one from 2016, I think. Mm-hmm. I can't say that I ever remember this even being out.
I remember this being out. I didn't see it for the first time until about 11, 12 years ago. And if I could sing, I would bust into a rendition of Bare Necessities, but change the lyrics to match this movie. I'm going to spare you, dear listener, from having that torture foisted upon you. But I actually enjoyed this version. Yeah. And I would say out of the animated version, the Jon Favreau version, and this is probably my favorite version.
Really? Uh-oh.
Yeah, the Jon Favreau version, I don't know. There's something about it, you know, and maybe it's the Disney live action adaptations, which I've yet to see one that I've been overly enthused about. But no, I think this one, when you strip out the singing and you make it more of a, I guess, more of a Tarzan style movie. Yeah, it just, I enjoy it. And I think Jason Scott Lee was really good in this film as Mowgli.
Yeah. And that the funny thing was, I thought it reminded me a lot of Aladdin. Like, you know, that same kind of the plot where it's like you have this sort of princess. I mean, Lena Headey's not necessarily a princess, but very kind of protected and I wouldn't say spoiled, but, you know, her overbearing father. And then you have this street rat, if you will, raised in the jungle that he can't be with him. And he's supposed to be, she's betrothed to somebody else. And, but, I will say that it wasn't quite what I was expecting due to that love story. And I really enjoyed it. You know, it did remind me a lot of Squanto, because it had good set design, an interesting story. Of course, it had those cheesy Disney villains, but it kept my attention. And even though you know exactly how it's going to end, I was still engaged. And let me ask you, Chad, I thought they did a great job with the animal actors and the visual effects, but at the same time, it kind of made it difficult from a narrative standpoint to not have the animals talk, like when he's around them, so that you can kind of get their thoughts. Did you have any issues with that, or how did you think they handled that?
No, I thought they handled it well. What helps is the fact that they are real animals that were there. You know, three people were killed by the tiger, which we don't talk about, but yeah. No, I thought the animals did really well. And I think, you know, because I think one of my problems with the Jon Favreau version was the aspect scale of the animals to Mowgli the kid. Like, I just remember the animals being so much larger. Mm-hmm. And that's what took me out of that, you know, part of what took me out of that film. Whereas this one was, again, they're real animals. They're next to him. And I think, you know, by not talking, it actually makes this movie realistic. As realistic as a movie about a child raised in the jungle by bears and panthers can be.
It's almost too realistic, because one of the thoughts that crossed my mind when the movie was over was, how in the world was this only PG? Because there's some very, very dark and violent stuff happening in the third act of this film. Yeah. It's funny you call Mowgli a kid. I had to look it up. Jason Scott Lee was 28 years old when he made this movie. You know, I think of Mowgli as being like this young man. But the last thing I was going to say, because there's no personnel connections in this film that I could find, I want to give some credit to Disney for these movies. I mean, obviously, Santa Claus notwithstanding, but for Squanto and Jungle Book, because they, again, good production design. It really felt like you were there. But I'm always fascinated when I see a movie and the lead is someone who I did not discover until much later or had known about for whatever reason. Like, I know Jason Scott Lee had been in, I guess he'd done Dragon, the Bruce Lee story before this, but I didn't realize that he was in this movie. I knew him more from Dragon. And then like in Squanto, Adam Beach, I only remember from Wind Talkers with Nicolas Cage. And I was like, oh, I thought that was like his breakout role. And you're like, oh no, he'd been in Squanto many, many years before. So Disney does a good job. I'll give them some credit there for casting and finding talented people at young ages. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't remember Jason Lee from Back to the Future 2?
Sadly, no.
Yeah. When they go to the future, he's part of Griff's gang.
Oh, is he in Griff's gang? Okay.
Yeah.
There you go. Another one of those pleasant surprises if I go back and watch it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll conclude this episode like we do with every episode, which is we'll look at the box office performance. And this is kind of why we put this episode together, to look at these five films, and we'll just go through them. Now, the first one, as I mentioned, was The Puppet Masters, which was released on October 21st. It finishes sixth place in its opening weekend with $4.1 million. The other films that opened against it were Love Affair, the Warren Beatty Annette Bening film, which finished third place, Radioland Murders, which finished in 15th place. And we also have a couple of limited releases that I want to talk about. The first of which is Bullets Over Broadway, the Woody Allen film that only played on two screens and had a ridiculous per screen average. But there's one other movie that opened the same week, or at least the weekend of The Puppet Masters. It only played on two screens, and I'm pretty sure most people probably didn't see it in the theaters, because I didn't even know about it until later, and I saw it on VHS. Chad, can you claim to be one of the people that saw Clerks in a theater?
I thought you were going to ask me what film, and I was going to say Clerks. But no, I did not see Clerks until this is the early days of the internet and meeting strangers online. And I met someone who had the Laserdisc version and made a VHS copy of it and sent it to me. And that's how I first discovered Clerks.
Really? Oh, wow. Yeah. I remember discovering it because Kurt Loder did a thing about it on MTV News one time. And I joke about it. At that point, I wasn't living in Hawaii. I was living in a very small town in Illinois, and we weren't getting that movie in the theater. So I had to get it on VHS, and then I watched it with a buddy of mine. And yeah, we laughed quite often in that one. But yes, Clerks came out the same weekend as The Puppet Masters. Yeah. First place that weekend was Pulp Fiction. And there were only two Disney films on the chart at the same time. And that was Quiz Show in 11th place and Ed Wood in 16th place. Now, it drops off the box office charts after only 2 weeks, and it grosses $8.6 million in its entire theatrical run. I could not find any budget info on that. Before we analyze that box office, we'll talk about Squanto, because it had a very similar performance, even though it came out 1 week later on October 28th. It finished 14th place in its opening weekend with only $1.1 million. The films that opened against it were Stargate, which finished in first place, The Road to Wellville, which finished in fifth place, and a movie that I have never heard of, Chad, called Silent Fall.
I feel like I have seen that.
It was directed by Bruce Beresford, and it stars Linda Hamilton and John Lithgow and the King of Touchstone, Richard Dreyfuss. I just do not know that one. That was a 10th place finisher. The only Disney films that were on the charts that week, Puppet Masters had slid down to 12th place, and Quiz Show was in 15th place. I hate to say it, it actually performed even worse than Puppet Masters. It dropped off the box office charts after 1 week. It only grossed $3.3 million in its entire theatrical run. Also couldn't find any budget information on that. So if you want to analyze the box office of these two films, you know, I feel like it seems like a decent release strategy. You know, if Puppet Masters, if you want to think of it as being a horror film, it's October, and the only other horror film on the chart was Wes Craven's New Nightmare, and Squanto centered around the origin of Thanksgiving, so it seems like a good time to put it out, but sadly, neither of these films remained on the charts by the time November rolled around. I think we talked about it on the last episode, but a lot of the Oscar hopefuls for that year came out kind of early, and they were also still on the chart at the time. You know, the four of the best of the five Best Picture nominees, Forrest Gump, Pulp Fiction, Shawshank Redemption, Quiz Show, were still in theaters at this time. So, you know, and then at the same time, you've also got those star vehicles. You've got The Specialist with Sylvester Stallone. You've got The River Wild with Meryl Streep. I mentioned Love Affair with Warren Beatty. And neither Puppet Masters or Squanto had a big star. And I don't think if they weren't quite good enough to gain traction in a crowded field.
Yeah, I agree with you, that sentiment. I'm sitting here trying to, I can't place the trailer or a TV spot for Squanto, which I know is actually in the show. If I would go back and listen to it right now, I would hear that. But I didn't, you know, watching it now, I didn't realize that it had anything to do with Thanksgiving. I guess I knew the name Squanto, but didn't realize his story. So, and I think, you know, with Santa Claus coming out too, right before Thanksgiving, that's what's going to draw people to the theater.
Yeah. I wonder if Thanksgiving's even mentioned in the Squanto trailers. Do people know? They just probably, oh, okay. They know from a history book. And then like you said it before, who was the audience for this? Mm-hmm. Can't fault them for making it. But again, I'm not expecting greatness at the box office, but I am expecting greatness at the box office from the next Disney film. It was released on November 11th, The Santa Claus. It finished in second place with $19.3 million in its opening weekend. Look at that. Santa Claus made more in its opening weekend than Puppet Masters and Squanto made combined in their entire run. Yeah. The other films that opened against it was, well, just Interview with the Vampire, which finished in first place. At the time of its release, there were no other Disney films on the chart. It drops to third place in its second week following the release of Star Trek Generations, which finished in first place. And the only new films that week were The Professional and Miracle on 34th Street remake. The Lion King, which we'll talk about in a minute, it gets re-released and finishes in fourth place. Give him credit there. Now, here's what I thought was kind of interesting. Santa Claus then jumps to first place over the long Thanksgiving weekend and stays in first place for the first weekend of December. I'm guessing good word of mouth, and deservedly so, yeah. We get some new releases around that time, but not great films. You know, Junior with Arnold Schwarzenegger, The Pagemaster, one of the worst Christmas movies ever. You and I watched Trapped in Paradise. And we also have a limited release of Cobb from Ron Shelton, who had done Bull Durham at the time. Chad, you guffawed. Trapped in Paradise?
Maybe I'm misremembering that. I thought I enjoyed Trapped in Paradise. Maybe we'll have to give that one another shot as well, just to refresh the memory. But I mean, Dana Carvey, Nick Cage, and is it John Lovitz?
John Lovitz, yeah. I can't tell if you're misremembering because I don't remember enough to remember either. but the
Santa Claus, movies, so little time.
Yeah, but the Santa Claus does spend the next 3 weeks after this in second place, behind films such as Disclosure and then Dumb and Dumber, which both topped the charts. The only other new releases around that time would have been the Wesley Snipes action film Drop Zone and also Speechless. Now, the final weekend that Santa Claus was in second place was the Christmas weekend. And all the new releases around that time were just a mixture of awards contenders and star vehicles. We'll go into them a little bit when we get to the Jungle Book, which came out on Christmas Day. But what I found interestingly enough is that a lot of those new Christmas releases leapfrogged it for New Year's weekend. So the Santa Claus, like everyone saw it leading up to Christmas. And then as soon as Christmas was over, Santa Claus dropped all the way down to sixth place. And all those movies that it had beat the week before all jumped past it. It gets one more weekend on the charts in January, and it finishes in 10th place before dropping off the box office charts after 9 weeks. But it grosses $144.8 million in its entire run. The budget was only $22 million, so that's quite good. I did want to point out it finished in the top three in its first 7 weekends and winds up finishing fourth on the year-end box office chart. Chad, it's pretty easy analysis for this one. You know, I feel like a lot of the movies around that time were catered towards adults. Not a lot of family films. The only thing I could see, in addition to The Pagemaster, which wasn't really that memorable, and then you had a movie called Little Giants. Remember that one with Rick Moranis? And that had been out for like a month by the time this had come out. So whoever saw it, wanted to see it, had already seen it.
That's an interesting time for that, because, I mean, I just watched that recently, and I would not peg that as a late fall winter film.
Isn't it football, though? Isn't it about football?
Yeah, it's football, but it's more like Pee-wee football, so I would have gone more, you know, like in September, maybe late August as a release date. But
okay, yeah. But I mean, it worked in favor of the Santa Claus. And the funny thing is, the other holiday films that were out didn't really fare much better. As we mentioned, Trapped in Paradise was a bomb. And then the Miracle on 34th Street remake, it stayed on the charts, but, you know, it was never really that close to Santa Claus, you know. And so I feel like it was a perfect mix of star power and holiday cheer. I mean, Home Improvement was quite successful at that time. And as I mentioned, people just, they wanted something that would warm their hearts. So it had great legs throughout the holiday season. And in a way, Disney should be grateful that there were no other family films for it to compete against around that time. Yeah. The next film we'll look at is A Low Down Dirty Shame. That was released on November 25th. It finished fifth with $8 million. The other films that opened against it were Junior, which was fourth place, and The Pagemaster, which was eighth place. First place that week was Santa Claus. And the other Disney film, the only other one, was The Lion King, which was in sixth place. So yes, Disney had three of the top six movies that weekend. Yeah, it stays in fifth place in its second weekend. Then it drops to sixth in its third week. As I mentioned, we had movies like Disclosure and Drop Zone that had come and pushed it down a little bit. In its fourth week, Low Down Dirty Shame drops all the way down to ninth, following movies we just talked about, Dumb and Dumber and Speechless. And then it plummets down the charts throughout the Christmas and New Year's weekend before dropping off the box office charts after 6 weeks. But it does gross $29.4 million in its entire theatrical run on a budget of only $10 million. So we always say, Chad, 2.5 times the budget means profit. So 3 times the budget. I got to be honest with you, if you want to analyze that box office, it's a lot more impressive than I was expecting, considering the quality of the film.
Well, do you think it had anything to do with Keenan Ivory Wayans isn't really not a box office star, but at this time, In Living Color was still popular. Damon Wayans, you know, he had Mo Money and he had done Last Boy Scout. So maybe it's the name Wayans sells the product more than the actual star of the film.
Well, yeah, I guess so. And then they'd go on to do the sitcom on the WB, right? The Wayans brothers, and then go on to Scary Movie and all that. True, yeah. And then as far as this movie, I feel like there were other comedies for adults, movies like Junior and Speechless. But those were warm comedies. But Dumb and Dumber was the only one that was more broad comedy, you know? And so I think this movie had its moment and just before the Christmas holiday kicked in. And so it did quite well. And I again, was not expecting to see those kind of numbers. And so good for them. Yeah. And then lastly, as I mentioned, The Jungle Book was released on Christmas Day. It finished in seventh place with $5.1 million. Now, here's our 1994 Christmas Day slate. Are you ready, Chad? This is what else opened. Street Fighter with Jean-Claude Van Damme. That finished in third place. Richie Rich finished in fifth place. Little Women finished in sixth place. IQ finished in 11th place. Mixed Nuts was 12th place. And Ready to Wear was 14th place. The first place film was Dumb and Dumber. Dumb and Dumber was the number one movie at Christmas 1994. Yeah.
That was a summer film.
And me too. Yeah. And then the other Disney films that were on the charts for Christmas weekend, The Santa Claus was in second place. Lion King was down in 13th place. And A Low Down Dirty Shame was still clinging to the top 20 in 18th place. And its second week, The Jungle Book jumps all the way up to third place because there were no new releases that week as well. And so it topped a lot of those movies that had come out around Christmas time. It does okay after the new year, finishes in sixth place, then ninth place, and then down to 10th. Now we're in January and I want to be nice, but I feel like the term that always comes up with a lot of the January releases is the dumping ground. So the films that Jungle Book has to compete with at this point would have been Higher Learning, Tales from the Crypt, Demon Knight, Far From Home, The Adventures of Yellow Dog, and a couple of other Disney films, House Guest from Hollywood Pictures, and one of the Touchstone movies we're going to be discussing soon, Bad Company. Yeah. The Jungle Book drops off the box office charts after 6 weeks. It grosses $43.2 million in its entire theatrical run. However, the budget was $27 million, so maybe not enough to break even, but still successful enough. It does finish 33rd on the year in box office charts. Chat, to be honest, I was shocked by the return on this one because we talk about how it seemed a little cheesy. I mean, maybe it was just aimed towards kids at Christmas time and they knew the animated film. They hadn't really done a lot of those live action remakes at this point. And, you know, there were no big stars in this film. So the only name recognition that it has is the title itself, you know? So, I mean, I guess we said, do you remember this movie being out in the theaters, you said, or no?
I mean, I remember it being out. I don't remember anybody seeing it.
Yeah. And it seems like it would appear to be for families, but did it get any word of mouth considering how violent it was? And then I feel like if you want to look at it from an adventure standpoint, it is kind of an adventure film. And there were no really adventure films on the charts. And maybe that helped. I mean, I don't know if you count Street Fighter or Drop Zone. Star Trek Generations had been out for a while. Stargate had been out for a while. So, yeah, I mean, give them credit. They dropped it when they needed to. And then lastly, I just want to point out the re-release of The Lion King. It was re-released on November 18th. And it stayed on the box office charts for 10 more weeks, including 5 weeks in the top 10. And so if you want to analyze that, you know, just like the Santa Claus, I think it helped fill the void of family films around the holidays. And at that time, Chad, you remember, you know, there was people didn't just want to wait for home video to see it again. I feel like this was their chance. You didn't know when VHS releases were going to happen. And interestingly enough, Chad, I did see that this is the highest selling VHS tape of all time. And if you count in Blu-rays and DVDs, it's the highest selling home video release ever.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm going to credit Mr. Carosi with that one. Yes. People love their Carosi.
People, all those Saved by the Bell fans made it happen. Yeah. I mean, I guess I could see families wanting to see this movie around the holidays, but I was surprised that it was still in the top 20 in January. But maybe that was due to that, like I said, that dumping ground that we talk about. Yeah. All right. Well, from an awards consideration standpoint, obviously we're not going to talk about The Lion King. We mentioned that in that episode already. But the only film that garners any major award nominations was The Santa Claus. It does win the People's Choice Award for Favorite Comedy Motion Picture. Tim Allen manages to get several nominations. The first one, he gets nominated for the Funniest Actor in a Motion Picture at the American Comedy Awards. He loses to Tom Hanks in that hysterical comedy, Forrest Gump. Tim Allen is also nominated as the favorite movie actor at the Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Awards, where he loses to Jim Carrey in Ace Ventura and The Mask. I guess they combine them together. And he also gets two MTV Movie Awards nominations, one for Best Comedic Performance, which he loses to Jim Carrey in Dumb and Dumber, and Best Breakthrough Performance, which he loses to Kirsten Dunst in Interview with the Vampire. I forgot that she was MTV... catnip at that point, I guess, right? Yeah. Chad's our favorite, our Young Artist Awards. We got some nominations. Santa Claus gets nominated as the Best Family Motion Picture Comedy or Musical. It loses to Lion King. No harm in that. And Eric Lloyd, who played Tim Allen's son in the film, he's nominated for Best Performance by a Young Actor Co-Starring in a Motion Picture. And he loses to Matthew McCurley in North. Well, as we like to recap the films like we do with our Touchstone films as well, would these five films fit the Disney ideal of singles and doubles? Chad, I got to say, it's a sort of a divide and conquer strategy if you look at it. You're going to touch on all these different genres without making too great of a financial stake, right? I mean, if you break it down real quick, here's these five movies. One of them is an adaptation of a famous science fiction novel that continued their relationship with the writers of Aladdin. One of them is a depiction of Native Americans at the time of the Pilgrims, which may not have been historically accurate, but was still an entertaining watch. One is a beloved holiday comedy for families that has spawned a franchise. One is an action comedy from the creator of one of the most popular sketch comedy shows of that era. And then lastly, we have a live-action adaptation of one of the most popular animated classics. So I can't really fault Disney for taking a chance on those movies that failed at the box office. And the successful ones paved the way for follow-ups or similar films in the genre.
I think you laid out a perfect case that if you were pitching to a studio, you laid out perfectly reasonable cases for making these films. And yeah, I think that late 1994 box office, like you, as you ran it down, you know, Forrest Gump, Pulp Fiction, Shawshank, you know, are just juggernauts that are probably keeping some of the more adult geared films like Puppet Masters and even Low Down Dirty Shame did well, but you know, it was probably could have done better in a less, in a different year maybe. But yeah, I think all of these, I mean, you know, looking at it, maybe Puppet Masters might not have been the most, wouldn't be the film that you would think would be huge looking at. But then, I mean, you look at Stargate and how well that did. So yeah, maybe that, you know, they could have had the Stargate if Stargate wasn't released.
Yeah, I mean, again, I can only imagine what must be difficult it must be for executives to kind of come up with an idea, marketing strategy for a lot of these movies. And here we've got five movies that came out in the span of, what, two and a half months. And Hollywood Pictures does what it's supposed to do. It makes a sci-fi science fiction thriller, and it makes like an action comedy for grownups, right? And then Disney comes through with your family holiday comedy. And then a sort of, like I said, like a thought-provoking film about Native Americans, and then an adaptation of an animated classic of theirs. Like, I know we say this a lot on the show since we did this reformat, but I'm really glad we did it like this. I'm really glad we did this reformat because I might not have gotten to see Squanto. And as awful as Low Down Dirty Shame is, again, it was still a lot of fun to watch. It made me, that movie of these five definitely made me the most nostalgic for 1994. Granted, one is set in a jungle, one is set in the time of the Pilgrims, but still, it really took me back. And so, again, I'm glad I saw it, even if it gave me a chance to just make fun of it and watch some actors that I liked overacting. Yeah.
Well, then I recommend you watch The Puppet Master, because that also will transport you back to 1994 as well.
Well, if we want to see it, or if our listeners want to see it, I can tell them that The Puppet Masters is streaming on Hoopla, the streaming service from the public library. Both Squanto and The Santa Claus are streaming on Disney Plus, not a sponsor. But as Chad mentioned, Low Down Dirty Shame is not streaming, and The Jungle Book also isn't streaming. I actually got a Low Down Dirty Shame on iTunes. I rented from iTunes, and I got the Jungle Book DVD from the public library. So, well, what's coming up on our next episode? Well, if you want to hear Chad, he and I will do our 1994 year in review episode. But before we do that, I will drop an episode which features an interview that I did with a very talented director who was responsible for two Touchstone films. Now, what were those films and who was that filmmaker? Well, you're just going to have to tune in next time to find out. This has been Out of Touchstone. My name is Mike DeKalb. You can find me on Twitter at Mike DeKalb. I'm also run the Out of Touchstone Twitter account, which is at Out of Touchstone. I got the Instagram handle as well, at Out of Touchstone. You want to shoot me an email, it's outoftouchstone@gmail.com. You want to follow Chad on Twitter as well, it's at Chad Smart. Chad, any final thoughts as we completely wrap up 1994? No more Touchstone. We got these other five movies out of the way. We're ready to wrap up the year.
Yeah, you know, it feels like it's taken us an entire year to get through 1994. So I'm ready to put a bow on that year, move into 1995, and see a lot of films that I've never seen before. So I think 95 is going to be a great discovery 1994 has been a nice look back, we'll say.
Absolutely. Again, very nostalgic about this time of our lives. And I'm glad we get to see some of these films. This is Out of Touch, Don, and we're out of time.
Out of Touchstone is a Honey Nerds production. For more information, go to outoftouchstone.com. Be sure to follow at Out of Touchstone on Instagram and Twitter. And also, please like, subscribe, and leave a review on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for listening.
So, you're cool, I'm cool, we're cool. Thank you. Good night.
McBain.
Yes?
I'm not gonna make it.
Oh, stop talking crazy.
No. Just do one thing for me. Get Mendoza.